Lee Aidan followed me up the stairs, moving with his usual stiffness. I kept glancing behind me to read his facial expression, but there was nothing. More than once, I imagined him grabbing my shoulder and pulling me back. More than once, I picked up my pace, desperate to get to the top of the stairs, to the corridor where I felt less vulnerable. I hated myself for thinking those thoughts.
"Remember yesterday, Aidan?"
I asked, leading him into the nursery.
"I fell over, and you wouldn't help me up."
"Well, that's not very nice for one person to do to another person.
We should always try to help each other. So if you fall down, I help you back up. If I fall, you should help me.
Especially seeing as I'm pregnant at the moment." I smiled down at my bump, but Aidan's gaze didn't follow mine. I cleared my throat and continued.
"This is difficult to talk about, Aidan, because I don't know why you did it. Why did you destroy the mobile and throw paint into the crib?"
I moved away from the offending area so that he could view his handiwork.
"It's not a very nice thing to do at all. That's not welcoming your baby sister to the home. Are you listening, Aidan? I can't tell if you're listening."
I stopped speaking. For the first time since he had arrived back from the hospital, Aidan was frowning. There was a line forming between his eyebrows and his face was angled down at the crib. Slowly he shook his head and backed away.
"Aidan,"
I whispered. He ignored me as usual, but this was different. He was absorbed by the sight of the broken mobile and red paint. He seemed frightened of them. Tingling sensations snaked up my spine and the blood drained from my face. Why was he so afraid of what was in that crib? He'd done it, so why did it frighten him? And then it dawned on me. He didn't remember doing it. Spooked by Aidan's reaction to the red paint, although I didn't want to admit it at the time, I called Rob and asked him to come over. He brought his parents with him and they sat with Aidan watching a silly comedy film in the living room, while I shared a pot of tea with my ex. He seemed tired today. Rob was generally an attractive man, but a little tiredness actually worked in his favour. Some stubble and eye bags made him sexier, though I tried my hardest not to remember.
"Did you read Amy's article?"
I asked. We'd already discussed Aidan's progress, though I'd decided not to tell him about the crib, and we'd exchanged pleasantries in the presence of his parents. The weather has turned quite mild for this time of year, hasn't it? Unseasonably warm makes you wonder if there's going to be a storm to clear it all away. I did. His uncharacteristically laconic response made me wonder if he was holding back. "And? Tell me what you thought." Hunched over his tea, Rob had to lift his chin to look at me. "You're not going to like it."
"Just say it."
"I think she was right." I exhaled in a rush.
"What?"
"Hear me out, okay? Don't go jumping to any conclusions. I know you'll take that to think I'm calling you a bad mother."
"I didn't think that until you just said it."
"Oh, well, anyway, I don't think that." His face flushed pink. He took to staring at his tea again. "It's just some of it rang true. Aidan was a little wild. We both thought it was a cool thing. He was a brave kid, an active kid. I loved the fact that Aidan could climb a tree and played in the garden all day collecting spiders. I don't know if it's some stupid macho thing, but it made me feel good that he was a boy's boy, you know."
"Yes,"
I answered. "And it is a stupid macho thing." His eyelashes flitted apart so he could roll his eyes at me. "What Amy said was mean-spirited and nasty. She was implying we'd let Aidan down, and I don't think we did." I bit my lip because there was a question I wanted to ask, but every time I thought it, tears pricked at my eyes, and I was afraid that my voice would crack.
"Was Aidan a bad kid?"
The weight of the question lifted from my shoulders, and I let out a long, slow breath.
"No, Emma, no. He wasn't a bad kid. He was a little bugger when he wanted to be. I don't think he was ever malicious, though, do you?"
I shrugged my shoulders, trying to ignore the way I'd begun to tremble. My entire body worked on stopping myself from bursting into tears. The pressure of taking care of my damaged son was getting to me. The exhaustion had seeped into every one of my muscles, but I wouldn't admit it at the time. Looking back now, I know I should have asked for more help. But I was stubborn, and I was determined to try and keep in control. The problem was that in trying so desperately to stay in control, I couldn't see that I was destined to lose it. Do you remember that camping trip to Brittany? Rob asked. I nodded, still gripping my tea to stop my hands from shaking. I was only half listening to him at this point. We went with Josie and Hugh. Oh boy, the hours of driving with Aidan cooped up in the car. I thought my eardrums were going to burst. Hugh had brought that huge tent with the little windows and open porch bit at the front. And we ate nothing but sausages and beans for a week. Anyway, do you remember that prank Aidan pulled on the German couple two tents down? I shook my head. The entire week was a blur. Josie and Hugh were beginning their rocky descent into a bad marriage, and Josie and I spent the week chugging Chardonnay. No matter how many times I tried to extricate myself from Josie's binging, she managed to pull me back in. Needless to say, Rob and Hugh were the responsible adults that week. What I did remember was laughing. Aidan would stay up late with us at night, and we'd sit around the campfire chatting about everything and nothing. Hugh liked to entertain the group, telling stories of his early years in an all-boys public school. I'd put my hands over Aidan's ears as he told us about walking in on other boys' improprieties. He had us in stitches, telling us stories with funny posh accents and silly faces. Do you remember how the campfire had that stupid little flagpole with a French flag on it? Rob continued. I think it was about half the height of a normal pole. Well, Aidan stole a couple of bras from the German woman's tent and shimmied up to tie them onto the pole. Poor woman was so large that the bras just started flapping in the wind. Why don't I remember this? Jesus! How old was he then? Over 5, Rob said. He was definitely a monkey. Though Rob appeared to be delighted by his son's naughtiness, I didn't feel the same way. Why didn't I remember him acting like that? I had a highlights reel in my mind of Aidan being a sweet, intelligent little boy, but there was more to him. He could be naughty. He used to steal things when he was 3. He'd grab chocolates from the supermarket aisles. But he didn't put them in our trolley. I once caught him sneaking them into a stranger's trolley when they weren't looking. I caught him at it, told him off and forgot all about it until Amy's article brought some of Aidan's naughtier acts back to me. Was that normal behaviour for a 3-year-old? I couldn't help but wonder if I was now actively trying to find examples of him being bad. Is everything okay? Rob asked. Fine, I lied. How's Josie doing? Any news from Hugh? I haven't called her. I finally let go of the mug to run my warm hands over my face. It was shameful that I hadn't been in touch with my best friend after her messy breakup. Why don't we look after Aidan for a few hours so you can go and see her? Rob suggested. You've had Aidan 24/7 since his release. You need a break. At that moment, a few hours away from Aidan sounded like pure bliss. As much as I wanted complete control over everything around my damaged son, I needed some time away from him. I needed room to breathe. Are you sure? Absolutely. I was already off my chair and searching for my car keys. Chapter 31. After a quick phone call, Josie told me she was in and that she hadn't been at work for a number of days. Even though I'd asked her to promise me she'd go to work, I'd expected as much. In all honesty, if Jake left me without a word, I wouldn't bother with work either. So I hopped into my car and drove across the village and up the winding hill towards the Barretts' home. It was warm enough to leave the house without a jacket, which was unusual for mid-October, and the blue sky above seemed almost superficial, or at the very least, fleeting. I was waiting for dark clouds to plunge us into darkness. While I'd been going through hell, the weather had mostly been fair and mild, belying my own stormy disposition. Yet another way the world decided to betray me. I took it steady around the narrow roads, pulling in warily when meeting other cars. The Barretts' home seemed eerily serene when I parked the car. The mild weather meant Josie's yellow pansies were still in bloom in pretty pots around the front door. But my gaze did not linger on them. I found it difficult to look at anything beautiful during those weeks. Josie answered the door after the first knock. Her large blue eyes were red-rimmed, and I noticed that she clutched her mobile phone in one hand. She was wearing leggings and an oversized jumper. "I'm so sorry I didn't come earlier," I said. "Are you kidding?" she replied. I'm ashamed for not coming to you. I mean, I know you said you wanted space and that you were fine, but still, with everything you're dealing with, my problem is tiny. Have you heard from him? Josie sighed and led the way through her house to the kitchen. Her messy bun bobbed up and down as she dragged her feet over the carpet. Her body was loose and lazy, but it almost seemed like an act, as though deep down she was in real turmoil. I knew her well enough to know that she dealt with stress by trying to pretend it wasn't happening, or at the very least, pretending she was fine with it all. Josie was a fake-it-till-you-make-it person. She wanted to see the bright side, but I wondered whether, when she was on her own at night, it really worked. Nothing, not even a text, but guess what? He posted something on Facebook. What? She nodded, gesturing to an open laptop on the breakfast bar. Hugh's profile was on the screen. For the first time, I realized that he'd updated his profile picture. It used to be a photograph of him and Josie on a skiing holiday, but now it was a solo picture of him smiling on top of a jet ski. Next to his profile picture was a status where he had checked in to the McCarran Airport in Las Vegas. What? I said again. What on earth is he doing there? I spoke to Stephen again. Apparently he's not replying to any messages from the family. Stephen admitted that he knew about the affair, but not the extent of it all. I bet they're gambling through our money as we speak. Oh, damn it, Emma, why did you have to be pregnant right now? I need a stiff drink. Hey, I won't judge you. I smiled. It felt good to talk about any other topic than the investigation and Aiden. This all seems so out of character, though. Has he taken off like this before? That's the thing, Josie said, her eyes lit up with the glitter of anger. Stephen said that he has done this before. Not that I knew about it. He took some receptionist to Cornwall for a dirty weekend. She uncorked a bottle of Malbec and began to pour. Fuck. I glanced around the kitchen, searching for evidence as to how Josie was coping. Most people would be relieved that there weren't any Chinese takeaway cartons or dirty dishes in the sink. The place was pristine, which was somewhat disconcerting. Had the weight of her husband's activities truly hit her? I'm so sorry, Joe. She shrugged. I knew it was coming. Deep down, I honestly think I'm relieved. She took a gulp of Malbec. Don't look at me with those puppy dog eyes. I know you think I'm going to go off the rails, but there's nothing to worry about. Are you sure? Because it's all in the past. Josie set her wine glass down on the kitchen side with a finality that warned me not to delve into the murky past I was about to bring up. Now, what can I get you? Herbal tea? Sparkling water? I groaned. Oh, what I'd give for a nice gin and tonic, or a measure of whiskey. I lifted my fingers and pinched them together. I was this close to opening a bottle of vodka the day Aiden came home. And then this week has got worse and worse. Did you see they've arrested the Duke? Arsehole, she said with real venom. Do you think he... She swallowed, uncertain whether to say it or leave the implication hanging. I honestly don't know, and that's the worst of it. I just want the person who hurt Aiden to be behind bars. I want all of this to be over. She nodded. Well, I always thought he was a shifty fucker. Don't worry, Em. If he did it, the police will find the evidence and they'll put him away. What are they doing for the investigation now? Well, apparently they're searching the surrounding area for any suspicious outbuildings or old shelters that could have been converted into a prison. But DCI Stevenson told me that there aren't always records for some of these old buildings, and the woods are really dense, so it's hard going. Most of their resources are taken up looking into the Duke. It took them ages to search Betherington, and now they're going through all the images on his computer. What I didn't say was that they were looking for images of Aiden. I didn't say it because it made me feel ill. They'll get him, Emma. I know they will. Josie reached across and took hold of my hand. She squeezed my hand and then leaned away, frowning. Is there something else wrong? You seem a bit peaky. It's going to sound really stupid. She laughed. I bet it won't. Remember that time I thought Argentina was in Europe? Oh, yeah. That was pretty stupid. Can't be worse than that, can it? She offered. It's Aiden. He's been acting really strangely recently, and I'm worried. How do you mean? I settled into the stool at Josie's breakfast bar. Well, I never expected him to be fine after everything he's been through. Of course, he will have been affected by the trauma of what he's been through, but I'm starting to wonder whether I'm going to need help with him. Whether I can't cope. His behaviour has gotten a little out of hand. First, he decided to cut up the curtains with scissors. Then he cut up the mobile for the new baby and threw red paint into the crib. Oh, shit. Emma, that's scary. I know. Jake thinks it isn't safe to bring a newborn home with Aiden there, but I just can't bring myself to send him away. Well, that's understandable. He was taken away from you. But I'm beginning to think that maybe Jake is right. Maybe I can't cope with Aiden, and maybe I'm being selfish by pretending I can. Being selfish about what? Emma, you are the least selfish person I know. If I'm putting Jake and my unborn child in danger because I can't let go of my son, then that's selfish, isn't it? Josie swallowed another mouthful of wine. I wouldn't say it's selfish, but if you're afraid of Aiden, you need to get some help. Jake might be right about it not being safe for your newborn with Aiden around. It isn't Aiden's fault, and it isn't your fault. It's the bastard who took him's fault. Do you remember him having behavioural problems when he was little? I can only remember the good things. But maybe that's because of what happened to him. I think I'm blanking on anything bad because I can't stand to think about it. Josie sighed. Honestly, Hugh had more patience with him than I did. Don't get me wrong, he was a lot of fun, but he was a bit tiring. And? I prompted, sensing that there was something she wasn't saying. He was a bit moody, He used to have tantrums quite a bit. I frowned. I remembered him throwing a wobbly in a supermarket once, but he was never that bad. I was getting to the point where I couldn't trust my own mind. Why did I keep pruning away the bad times? An hour later, I left Josie's house and made my way down the gravel drive to my car. The wind had whipped up, and it howled through the rough valley forest below. I turned my head towards the second hill overlooking Bishoptown. There it was, Wetherington House, standing tall and proud above the village. At one time, the village was entirely owned by the Duke of Hardwick, though the family had sold much of the land since those days. The house had been closed to the public since the police inquiry, but I knew there was a goods entrance at the rear of the property, because I'd once snuck in with Rob. It was a dare we'd had while drinking Lambrini on the grounds of the house. I got in the car and started the ignition. Butterflies tickled at my stomach, but I knew I needed to get some answers. Though I was filled with nerves, I tried my best to back out of Josie's drive carefully and warned myself not to let my adrenaline take over like it had on the day I went to the GP surgery. No. I needed to keep a cool head. It was a short drive to Wetherington. The scene of Bishoptown spread beneath the hill in a patchwork of green fields and dark forest dotted with small cottages and local pubs. Who would think that a monster lived in this beautiful place? No one had suspected a thing, and that was the most dangerous aspect of this entire sorry story. No one had even had an inkling until the day Aiden stumbled out of the woods. He had brought his own abuse to our attention, but he held the full story locked up tight inside. If Aiden wouldn't tell me what happened, maybe someone else could. I navigated the twists and turns down the driveway towards the stately home. In order for this to work, I needed to make sure I knocked on the door of the private wing of Wetherington. I had no idea if the Duke and Duchess were even living in the mansion at the moment. Perhaps they had nipped up to a private residence in the Highlands, or a summer cottage in Devon. DCI Stevenson hadn't gone into much detail about the conditions of his bail. I hesitated for a moment after lifting the handbrake. What was I doing? What if I was arrested? I scratched at the angry red rash between my thumb and forefinger as I worked up enough courage to open the door. This was for Aidan, but it was also for me. I needed to talk to someone who might have some answers. Before I left the car, I pulled off my thick cardigan. I was already sweating. I didn't need the extra layer, even with the winds. The gravel of the back drive was difficult to walk on, especially when carrying extra weight at the front of my body. I was completely off balance and forced to stumble my way to the back door. But I got there without anyone telling me to clear off, and I knocked on the old oak wood. 3 raps. I'd expected Wetherington to be something like Downton Abbey, with a butler ready to answer the door. That wasn't the case at all. A small, stooped woman with greying but neatly set hair opened the door. She looked me up and down, no doubt taking in my shocked expression, and her lips thinned to a tight line. "Do you know who I am?" I asked. The words were strange coming from my mouth, especially given who I was facing, but then I wanted her to know. I wanted her to know who she was looking at.
"I do," she said. "You'd best come in."
Chapter 32. As I followed the back of her tasteful cream cashmere cardigan, it struck me that I had absolutely no idea what to call this woman. Would I call her Duchess, or would I call her Mrs. Graham Lennox, or what about Maeve, her actual name?
"He isn't here," she said, "in case you were wondering."
The thought had entered my mind. As soon as I stepped foot over the threshold, I wondered whether the man who took my son shared the same breathing space as I did. That was if he had taken my son.
"I asked him to leave," she said,
stepping through an ornate doorway into a small but beautiful little sitting room, adorned with antique dresses and racehorse paintings.
"You couldn't have him here, in this house with me. Not after the things the police found on his computer. I'd shared a bed with that man for over 50 years. Not for another night. Would you like a cup of tea?"
"No, thank you," I said. Entering the house, I had found myself feeling more and more like the teenager who snuck onto the property as a dare with her boyfriend. I clutched hold of my bag and stared at the beautiful antiques like a child in a posh department store. I certainly didn't want to spill anything.
"Make yourself comfortable," she said, gesturing to a floral sofa with mahogany legs.
"Thank you for letting me come inside. I didn't expect you to." She laughed as she settled into a red velvet armchair across from the sofa.
"I bet you didn't."
Her makeup was perfectly applied, with pink lipstick and a little rouge on her wrinkled skin. She sat with her legs crossed and cut the figure of a woman holding everything together.
"I wanted to meet you. I have wanted to meet you ever since my husband was arrested. I feel somewhat responsible, you see. Though I had no idea about the lengths of my husband's obsession, did have a suspicion that I constantly ignored."
She moved her hand in a vague swatting motion.
"I never knew for certain, and I never knew what was wrong, but I always suspected that my husband had a dark side. This may sound extremely trifling after what you've been through, but you have no idea how much pressure I have been under to maintain certain standards throughout my marriage. Divorce was not an option for me 50 years ago. So even when I realized I'd married a dud, there was no going back."
"But if you thought he was a monster..."
"What is a monster?"
she asked.
"Is it a scary ghoul hiding behind the bedroom door? Is it some sort of beast with sharp fangs? No, those things don't exist. Monsters are men and women just like us, and they have the ability to hide their true face. No, I didn't think I'd married a monster. I thought I'd married a homosexual. I never caught Edward looking at children in that way. I only knew that he wasn't particularly interested in me. We managed to continue the family line, but that was about it.
And your kids? She shuffled uncomfortably and removed her glasses like she was stalling for time.
I've broached the subject with them. Neither remember him doing anything.
She closed her eyes, and I realized that she had removed her glasses in an attempt to distract me from the fact that she was trying not to cry.
If you didn't know, it isn't your fault,
I said. The Duchess leaned back into the chair and let out a soft laugh.
And is that what the newspapers say about you? Oh, the mother is always at fault. So is the wife, really. Women are supposed to control men. Isn't that how it goes? What's that saying again? Behind every great man is a great woman. We're supposed to be the ones holding them up or holding them back. Forget having our own lives. Forget our own careers and loves and losses. We're the matriarchs.
She narrowed her eyes and clenched her hands as she said the word matriarchs. Her body slumped forward, suddenly appearing exhausted.
For what it's worth, I don't think James ever touched your boy. He hasn't been particularly active for the last decade, riddled with gout and in remission from bowel cancer. My husband has not been a well man. If he ever has abused children, and I'm not certain that he has, then I would say it happened long ago, long before your boy went missing.
She had crumpled into herself, leaning over like a wizened old crone. The woman had aged a decade just speaking to me.
Thank you for your time.
I stood and collected my bag. For a brief moment I hesitated, searching for some words of comfort. I grasped at nothing. The Duchess did not watch as I turned around and left her crumpled up on the antique armchair in the middle of that vast, stately house. Since meeting the Duchess, there have been times when I see the shape of her body wilted forwards on that armchair in my dreams. She haunted me. After the investigation settled down, the Duchess of Hardwick would die less than 3 years after I met her on that mild October day. I attended her funeral, accompanied by Aidan. It was a quiet affair with a surprisingly small number of attendees. They talked about her strength as a mother and a wife and how efficiently she had run the day-to-day workings of Wetherington House. Her children decided to sell the house, and the last I heard, it was to be converted into a museum, with many of the antiques auctioned off at Weatherby's. Her husband outlived her. I'd left Aidan with Rob and his parents for longer than I'd intended to, though I didn't rush back. I needed time to contemplate Maeve Graham Lennox's words. I pitied her and what she had been through. Families like hers weren't designed to deal with such gritty issues. For them, this was scandal, and it meant their high reputation ended up dragged through shit. Their reputation was everything. Would people still pay to enter Wetherington House? Perhaps they would, but there would be an air of morbid curiosity. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the computer where the Duke stashed his kiddie porn. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that we are all monsters. Yes, us. We're monsters. We enjoy reading about these stories. We're the voyeurs of human suffering. As soon as I pulled into the drive at home, I had the tickling feeling in my gut that I get when something feels wrong. The front door was open for a start. I parked the car, unclicked my seatbelt, and hurried out of the car. I was almost knocked over by a blonde woman half-dragging a boy of about 10 who was crying and holding a bandaged hand. Rob hurried out after her. "I'm so sorry about what happened," he said. He had to jog to keep up with the woman and had his hands out in placation. It was only after I'd had a moment to take in the chaos that I realized I recognized the woman as Siobhan Michaels. Her son Billy attended the Bishoptown Primary School, and she worked as a manager at Sonia and Peter's holiday cottage business. "I hate to say it, Rob, but the papers are right. He's a menace,"
Who's a menace?
I snapped, moving into the turmoil. Siobhan stepped around me.
I'm sorry, Emma. I think what has happened to Aidan is awful, but I don't think he's safe to be around children.
Well, not right now, no, I said.
He's still healing after what happened to him. Rob, what the hell have you done?
Rob's face was pale and sweaty. He was grimacing and his jaw was clenched. I noticed his eyes flitting around the yard as if searching for reporters.
Oh, it wasn't my idea. I got ambushed, all right?
As Siobhan climbed into her car with the crying child, I grabbed Rob by the arm and forced him to look at me.
What did your parents do?
I think we were trying to help. They thought if Aidan had someone to play with, it might help his development.
What happened?
I asked, my stomach already sinking down to my knees.
He stabbed the kid in the hand with the scissors.
I let go of Rob's arm and staggered back.
Fuck!
Billy kept playing with the remote control for the television. He kept snatching the thing out of Aidan's hand. I told him to stop it, but it seems Siobhan has spoiled that little shit rotten because he wouldn't listen to me. The next thing I know, the kid's pulling on Aidan's hair. So Aidan picked up these scissors from the coffee table and stabbed him in the hand. They were kid scissors, so they didn't do much. Just broke the skin a little.
He rolled his eyes.
You'd think the kid had been shot from his reaction.
Jesus, Rob! How could you think this would be a good idea?
I'm really sorry.
Just get your parents and get out, I snapped.
What?
I'm serious. You've done a shit job here. It's time for you to go.
I turned my back on him and stormed into the house. Chapter 33. After that incident, I wasn't sure if Sonia was malicious or just an idiot. Somewhere in that thick-skulled head of hers, she thought that inviting Siobhan over to my house would kill two birds with one stone. For one thing, it set up Rob with a woman who wasn't me. For another thing, it introduced Aidan to another kid, which I genuinely believe she thought was going to go down well and get her some brownie points as the perfect caregiver. Sonia's endgame was Rob and Aidan under one roof, with me free to be with my other family. I was sure of it. I didn't tell Jake about the incident with the scissors, and I especially didn't tell him about meeting Maeve Graham Lennox. That, as far as I know, remained a secret between me and the Duchess herself. The next day, a grey October Tuesday, I had a call from DCI Stevenson confirming what I already knew. The Duke hadn't taken Aidan. The Duke had been in hospital for long periods of time during the last 10 years. There was no evidence of any kind of room that could have been used to keep Aidan captive, and he had an alibi for the day Aidan was taken. He'd been attending a shoot at a different stately home in Yorkshire with a lord who could corroborate his whereabouts. It all brought me back to the beginning. Who took my son? Who did this to him? Who broke him? I no longer made picnics and pretended that we were eating on Mount Kilimanjaro. I didn't show him my favourite children's films and television shows, nor did I hold his hand if we crossed the street in the village. I certainly didn't talk to him like he was still the little Aidan I'd known 10 years ago, if that boy had even existed. I was pulling away, though I didn't realise it at the time. Yes, the thought of Aidan's kidnapper still being out there made me feel sick, and I wanted little more than for that man to be put behind bars, if it was a man. I remember being on the phone to DCI Stevenson, begging him to look harder. Who could it be? Who was it? I was withdrawing from them all. From Jake, from Aidan, from Rob, and from everyone else. My dreams drifted between nightmares about Aidan's attacker to nightmares about my parents' car accident to disturbing but erotic dreams about Rob and Jake. Sometimes Jake wrapped his hands around my throat and squeezed until I couldn't breathe. I called DCI Stevenson over 5 times that Tuesday, leaving strange messages with some assistant at the police station.
Look into Brian, who runs the White Hart. Have you spoken to Jeff from the farm outside Bishoptown?
There had to be something in the farms. They were sprawling with outbuildings. It seemed like a genius idea. Why hadn't I thought about the farms before? I even drove Aidan around the village to see if he reacted strangely to the buildings. Of course, looking back now, it didn't make much sense. Jeff's farm was miles away from the woods, so unless the farmer had driven Aidan to the woods and dumped him there, chances were he wasn't the kidnapper. I started writing to Aidan as I sat in silence and watched him from the kitchen table. I angled myself so I saw him staring at the television set, watching people on daytime TV discuss matters they were unqualified to discuss, and I wrote to him to save myself talking to him.
When you were little, you used to make cakes out of mud and throw them at Nana. She didn't find it as hilarious as you did, though. Do you remember? And when you were 4, I read The Call of the Wild to you. A few chapters every night before you went to sleep. When you were a baby, you were afraid of your own nappies. You'd cry after I took the nappies off, not before. A little older than 3, and you were obsessed with hugging everyone and everything, even if they didn't want to be hugged. The leg of a random man in Costa, a tree in the park, a feral cat that roamed the village. You hugged them all, and you didn't care who they were or where they came from. These are all the things I know. That was how I signed every letter, as a reminder to myself that I did remember his childhood. I know you, I whispered to myself. But it was a lie, because I didn't know Aidan at all. He was an alien to me now. His abuse had made him a completely different person, and I couldn't forgive myself for being so afraid of him, because it's victim blaming, isn't it? Victims shouldn't have to explain their bizarre actions after trauma, but it's so difficult for the rest of us to understand why they behave in that way. If a grown woman is raped and she doesn't scream for help, why didn't she scream? That's what the jury can't get their head around. Why didn't she scream? Why won't Aidan tell us who took him? Why won't he talk at all? The house was filled with unspoken words. My conversations with Jake had turned to pleasantries to stop us arguing about Aidan's presence in our house. He welcomed Sonia's offer to take Aidan with gusto, but I put my foot down. As afraid as I was of my son, I couldn't stand the thought of not seeing him every day. Besides, he was my responsibility, for better or worse. Mothers don't get to return a child like it's a toy that isn't working properly. I needed to look after him to make sure he didn't hurt anyone. That rested on my shoulders. And then to top everything off, as I was sat at the kitchen table writing another of my manic letters to a son who was sitting a mere few feet away from me, I heard a voice I recognized. Amy. The chair scraped against the kitchen tiles as I abruptly rose from my seat. I hurried into the living room and dropped onto the sofa next to Aidan. By this point, I had virtually given up trying to protect Aidan from the media. He wasn't stupid. He knew what was going on anyway, or so I thought. Though he barely reacted to anything, I noticed the way his eyes scanned the headlines. Once I caught him flipping open a newspaper to a page plastered with his face. He didn't point or gasp or in any other way react, but I could tell that he understood what was going on. I turned up the television. Amy sat with her legs pulled together and her hands resting on her knees like a prim little girl waiting to have her picture taken. While her expression was relatively impassive, there was a haughtiness to her chin that I recognized for what it was. Anger. This Amy was nothing like the meek, mousy girl I had worked with for years, nor the girl I remembered from school. I thought about the way she had sobbed, as she begged me for forgiveness after we thought Aidan had drowned. I remember the way her eyeliner had smudged all the way down her face. It was all phony. This girl, this woman, in her two-piece skirt suit and deep blue blouse, an obvious choice to highlight her eyes, was an attention-seeking, jealous bitch. "Now, we've all been talking about the shocking case of Aidan Price," said the grey-haired male presenter. "Not only was Aidan declared dead 3 years ago, he was found walking the streets in a disorientated fashion, and police believe he has been held hostage for a decade. It truly is the most shocking crime, well, certainly, that I've heard of, and possibly the most tragic too. It's been hard to make sense of the nature of this crime, and it's sometimes quite difficult to understand the behaviour of both Aidan and his mother. We're joined here today by Amy Perry, a friend of Emma Price Hewitt and schoolteacher of Aidan Price. Thank you for joining us today."
"Thank you for having me, though I wish it was under less tragic circumstances."
She beamed at the camera, revealing her white teeth. It was at that moment I realized she'd had work done. She'd had her teeth bleached before this interview. You've known Emma Price Hewitt for many years, haven't you?
I have. We actually went to school together.
And you were friendly?
We were, mostly,
Amy said, glancing slightly at the camera.
Emma was a lot more popular than I was. We hung out in some of the same circles. Bishoptown on Ouse is a very small village, so everyone knows everyone.
We know that Emma fell pregnant when she was 18. That must have been very difficult for her.
Oh, it was, said Amy, as if she had any insight into what I was thinking and feeling at the time. She would come to school with red eyes and smudged makeup. She was having a really tough time, I think.
Do you think the stress of having a child so young impacted on Aidan as a baby?
I would say so, Amy replied, nodding along to the question. Aidan was a fussy baby. He would cry a lot whenever she walked him around the village.
Lying cow. And you were actually Aidan's schoolteacher, weren't you? Asked the presenter.
That's right. I taught Aidan at ages 5 and 6.
Was he a well-behaved little boy? Amy paused.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say he had a few behavioural problems. He was a very energetic little boy with a great curiosity for life.
In the article you wrote for The Mail, you mentioned that Aidan was quite a reckless little boy and that you didn't think he had been taught to stay safe.
Yes, I believe strongly that he hadn't been taught how to protect himself. It's sad, really. I mean, I love Emma like a sister, and I would never accuse her of negligence, but you have to wonder, if she hadn't allowed Aidan to get so feral, maybe he wouldn't have wandered off that day, and maybe he wouldn't have gone off with a stranger.
I stood up and walked around the room, squeezing my fists closed and unclosed. My pulse was racing, and Amy's smug face had a huge target on her forehead. I wanted to smash that television screen, but I didn't. I needed to see what else she had to say.
So our phone in today is on the subject of making sure our children are safe. That's why we have child behavioural expert Raj Patel with us on the sofa. Please call on...
I was dialing. I couldn't help it. I was dialing into the show. I spoke to some runner for the show first. They told me to turn off the television before I went live on air. I didn't tell them who I was. I lied and said I was Emily from Yorkshire. I waited for a few moments as my blood pumped so hard and fast I felt the pulse in my fingertips. Before I knew it, the presenter was introducing me.
Emily from Yorkshire, what is your question?
My question's for Amy.
Who do you think you are? Where do you get off blaming Emma Price when you're the one who was supposed to be watching Aidan when he was taken? He walked away on your watch, Amy, not his mother's. When children go to school, parents expect them to be taken care of. But teachers aren't parents. Children need to be taught, she started. Shut up, Amy, you lying cow! You sat there and you gave me that doll and you pretended to be my friend.
Who is this?
Do you remember turning up at my house 2 months after Aidan was taken? Do you remember getting on your knees and begging for my forgiveness? I wrapped my arms around you and I told you it was all forgiven, when I should have been driving a knife through your back, like the one you've driven through mine.
Chapter 34. Maeve Graham Lennox had talked to me about how normal men and women can wear a mask. Beneath that mask is the potential for any of us to become a monster. I'd seen Amy's mask slip, and I knew she was as much a monster as anyone else. I hated her then. I hated her freshly dry, clean silk blouse and her newly whitened teeth. I hated her TV hair and proper pose, and I was absolutely convinced that she was the one who took Aidan. I called Denise and DCI Stevenson, and I begged them to look at her again, but they told me she had been dismissed from the investigation. She had been accounted for during the storm. There was only a 5-minute period while she was on her own, and it wasn't enough time to take Aidan to wherever his enclosure was. But still, I couldn't let it go. That woman had transformed into another person before my eyes. How long had that other person existed? How long has she been planning to go to the press with her story?
Jake thought I was crazy.
No one who took a boy and kept him locked up for 10 years, he lowered his voice, and did all that stuff to him, would ever go on TV and draw attention to themselves.
Even Rob agreed, and he was generally suspicious of everything. In the midst of all that angst, I still took Aiden to his therapy session with Dr. Foster on Wednesday.
How's Aiden getting on?
She asked.
He's the same, really. No change.
And you?
She asked.
It's my due date in a week, I said. So I have a lot to think about.
But you're so small,
she noted. When I was 9 months pregnant, I looked more like a cow or beached whale. She trailed off and smiled to cover up her mistake.
Lucky,
I finished.
In some ways, I suppose.
So, are you all set? She asked, changing the subject. I frowned. You've just got to put the crib together and then we'll be done.
How has Aiden been handling the changes going on around the house?
This was my moment to tell Dr. Foster about the incident with the crib. But my maternal instinct held back. While I actually liked Dr. Foster, I did not completely trust her. I certainly didn't want her to recommend that my son be taken away from me.
He's doing okay. He's been in the nursery and he knows what's happening, but he still isn't talking, so there's not much to report.
And his drawings?
Violent, I thought. So much more violent than before. He drew blood on steel, blood on leaves, blood in the crib. He had worn his red colouring pencil right down and his tube of red paint was down to the last drop.
Same as usual.
I glanced nervously across to where Aiden sat colouring on his own. Away from us. That was who Aiden was now. He was an outsider looking in.
I have been thinking about Aiden, and I believe it's now time to look at some other treatment options.
I sat up straighter. I hadn't been told about any other options. Dr. Foster lifted her hands in a calming gesture.
Don't worry, it's nothing too taxing. But it is important. I want Aiden to start seeing a speech therapist to help him. Now that he's settled into his environment, I think it's time for us to actively help him speak.
Okay.
It's been over 2 weeks, and this level of mutism is unheard of. DCI Stevenson and I think it's best that we push Aiden a little harder. Now, I don't want to push too hard, which is why I've suggested a speech therapist.
I understand, I said.
Good. I'll get my diary and give you some recommendations.
I scratched the rash on my hand and pondered over what Dr. Foster hadn't said during our conversation. It was time for Aiden to talk, because otherwise, we would never find out who took him 10 years ago. Bump was active that day. When your baby is kicking, the last thing you want to be doing is driving. I couldn't wait to get us home. When we arrived, Aiden disappeared into the garage and I sloped into the kitchen for a glass of water and a biscuit. My phone buzzed. Then I checked the screen. I saw Rob's number.
Hello. Emma, they've taken Dad in for questioning.
What? He spoke quickly in a breathless, panicked voice. I heard movement in the background of the call and imagined Rob pacing up and down, unsure what to do with his anxious energy.
The police asked him to go down to the station for questioning. They say they've been reviewing CCTV footage from the day Aiden was taken, and they've seen him walking near the bridge 10 minutes before the abduction.
Are they serious?
I don't know what's going on. Maybe they think he saw something, but it seemed formal, like he was a suspect. Mum's going mad. Oh, so stupid. He only went down there to take some pictures of the flood. And how the hell would he keep Aiden locked away for 10 years without any of us knowing? Rob, try to stay calm. I'm so fucking angry, Emma.
I know, but that isn't going to help anything.
I need to go. Mum needs me.
I slumped into the chair at the kitchen table. Of all the possible suspects, I'd never thought to distrust Aiden's grandfather. The man was a walking bore. But he was a birdwatcher and a carpenter. He spent quite a lot of his time outdoors in silly sheds staring at birds. If he could build a shed, what else could he build? A cage? I shook the thoughts out of my head. No, I knew Peter. He wasn't But then I thought about how I'd been stupid enough to think I knew Amy. I'd seen how her mask had slipped, and now I knew her true face. What if the same were true for Peter? I sipped the cool water and wished for something stronger. The baby moved, reminding me that it wouldn't be a good idea to open the bottle of brandy we'd had stashed somewhere. Another unwanted Christmas present we hadn't got round to throwing out. Instead, I put my head in my hands and tried to work it all out in my mind. I knew that Aidan had gone missing between 1:15 and 1:20 p.m. That was when Amy said she got distracted by the flood and left the classroom for 5 minutes. Only one of Aidan's classmates said they saw him leave, and that was Jamie, a little boy whose father worked in the GP surgery with my late mother. Apparently Jamie had asked Aidan where he was going, and Aidan hadn't answered. At that time, Amy had been placing buckets under streams of water leaking through the roof along the school corridor. The head teacher and the janitor were walking around the school building assessing each classroom. Jake was with Simon from IT, looking for dry classrooms to relocate their students. According to those statements, none of them had time to take a child and hide him somewhere. I highly doubted they would have had time to take him into Rough Valley Forest either, though I didn't know for certain that was where Aidan had been kept captive. If Peter had been alone for the longest amount of time out of all of them, maybe I couldn't trust my son's grandfather after all. I felt sick. I'd felt sick all throughout this process, but especially now. I ran my finger along the rim of the glass and tried to piece everything together. After a few minutes, I called Rob, but there was no answer. Then I tried Jake, but was sent straight to his answering machine. I got up from the chair and paced around the kitchen. My hands were red raw from where I'd continued to rub them. Hand lotion was doing nothing for me now. This was all going on for far too long. There's only so much pressure the human mind can take. I was reaching breaking point. I had been ever since that woman keyed my car. I'd been walking along a razor-sharp edge, barely keeping my balance. I just needed to hold on for Aidan. It was strength he needed, not weakness. I decided to make something. Perhaps using my hands would help. So I went to the kitchen cupboards to take out a loaf of bread and make us both some sandwiches. I highly doubted either of us were hungry, but at least I'd be doing something. That was when I noticed the stack of letters on the end of the kitchen work surface. We had a letter organizer, but with everything going on, the mail had ended up piling on the edge. Denise and Marcus hadn't been around as much, so Aidan's fan mail was going neglected. There were letters from all over the world telling me how sorry they were for what had happened to Aidan. Though I also got letters from all over the world telling me I was a terrible mother and that I deserved to go to hell. What caught my eye was the card from the post office. It was one of those cards that informed you that the incorrect postage had been placed on the letter. I would have ignored it. I didn't particularly want to pay for postage for another letter of abuse. But the card had the postcode of the sender written on it. It was local. I put the postcode into Google and it came up with York College of Lifelong Learning. That was where Jake taught art history every Tuesday and Thursday. It was also where I'd requested a prospectus from to check that Jake actually worked there. The woman on the phone hadn't known the instructor's name, only that he'd taken some leave, and the website had only listed the courses, not the names of the tutors. I'd forgotten all about requesting the brochure, and now it seemed the incompetent woman on reception had underpaid the postage when sending it to me. I snatched up my bag and car keys and hurried through to the next room. Get your coat, Aidan. We're going to the post office. Chapter 35. Though there were dark clouds hovering above, the temperature remained unseasonably warm for October. As I drove through the narrow streets of Bishoptown Village, I sweated in the thick jumper I'd worn over elasticated jeans. Aidan sat quietly next to me with his hands on his lap. Between us, 90s pop blasted out of the radio. I didn't ramble to Aidan like I used to. There was a pile of letters addressed to him in the drawer of the desk in the bedroom, but as far as us chatting went, it didn't. When I think about this part of the ordeal, this moment in the crazy weeks that led up to my second child's birth, I wonder whether I'd lost hope. I think about it like that in a way to challenge myself and who I believe I am. Did I give up on Aidan? Perhaps I did, however briefly. Sometimes I think that giving up on a victim is unforgivable. Other times I consider the term lost cause with more weight than I used to. Since Aidan's reappearance, I'd avoided the post office. It was run, as all post offices seem to be, by middle-aged women and men so camp they'd fill the stereotype quota on a sitcom. In Bishoptown, though, I knew the names of all the post office workers. There was Sandra, with a son at Cambridge University. Everyone in the whole village knew Sandra's son was at Cambridge. Bless her proud mother's heart. And Sam, a young guy in his 20s, who once gave me a recommendation for a good beautician to sort my eyebrows out. I hadn't experienced that level of passive-aggressive criticism since my mother was alive, but I took the damn number anyway. The two of them called themselves collectively San Sam, as though they were two celebrities who had married and thus merged their personas into one behemoth of infamy. Though San Sam were kind at heart and generally pleasant, up until this point I had always sent Denise to the post office to sort out the mail, partly because the police were worried about any unpleasant hate mail, and partly because I knew they'd fuss over me and I wasn't sure if I could cope with that. However, I soon realised that I couldn't have been more wrong. When I stepped into the post office with Aidan next to me, the place went deathly silent. I joined the back of the queue and tried to pretend that I hadn't noticed how the usual chatter of the shop had ceased as soon as I'd walked in. The stuffiness of the small shop made me sweat even more, and I felt a trickle run down my temple. I wiped it away with the sleeve of my jumper and hoped I wouldn't have to wait too long. San Sam were both at the counter, serving a customer each. I was third in the queue behind two OAPs I didn't recognise. If there was ever a group of people who were forgotten about in Bishoptown, it was the elderly. They rarely left the house, but when they did, it was as a pack. Strength in numbers. Unfortunately for them, we tended not to really see them, unless they were in the way, like they were today. It was sad, and it was something I was aware of, but I had too much on my plate to worry about it any further at that time. It was Sandra who was free first. I flashed her a wan smile and led Aidan over to the counter. I couldn't bring myself to leave him in the car alone. I need to pay this postage. As I passed the card through the gap underneath the glass screen, I felt like everyone in the post office was watching me. I wiped my forehead again.
Sure,
Sandra took the card, glancing at Aidan as she scanned a barcode on the front of the card.
£1.80, please.
I had the change ready. I slid it through the gap.
I'll just get the letter.
As Sandra walked away, Sam glanced over and gave me a small half-smile. He opened his mouth to speak, but then he stopped. His gaze dropped to his hands and he drummed on the counter like he was trying to fill the silence. I was the only customer left in the shop and the awkwardness reached a new height. Luckily, Sandra bustled back to the front of the post office.
Here you are.
Thanks. The envelope was thick, A4 sized and slightly battered at the corners. I rammed it into my bag and began to leave with Aidan.
Emma!
I turned back to face Sandra. Her mouth was flapping open and shut and I averted my eyes so as not to make the moment even more awkward.
I'm really sorry about Aidan,
she said.
Me too,
Sam joined in.
Thanks,
I mumbled, hurrying to leave the shop before the tears emerged from my eyes. My shriveled heart twanged a little, like someone had plucked a taut string. That was something I never got used to. The overwhelming feeling you get with genuine concern or well wishes. Most people are utterly fake. They don't care about you and they barely manage to hide it. Then you get people like San Sam, who knock you over with a sudden burst of kindness, and it's so stupid because they only said sorry. I managed to pull myself together back in the car. I took the letter and ripped open the flap while Aidan sat watching me. At least he seemed vaguely aware of his surroundings for a change. There were times when he ignored whatever was going on around him. The prospectus was thick, which surprised me for such a small college. How many courses did they offer? I flicked through to the arts and humanities section and found the page for art history. My eyes scanned down the page, searching for Jake's name. But when I found the course, art history on Tuesday and Thursday evenings, the name next to the module was not Jake Hewitt. It was David Brown. I frowned and searched again. Had I got the wrong course? This time I trailed every single name with my finger, making sure that I hadn't somehow read the wrong name alongside the wrong course. No, there was no mistake. Jake Hewitt.